Remember, it's the Rising Sun Part 2. Go ahead.
No, you got it, man. You got it.
Go ahead. Fuck. I feel like a cheese dog. All right. Good morning, folks, and thank you for listening to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic, Part 2 of the Rising Sun. Good morning, Luke.
Morning, Alan. How are you?
Pretty good. I was up for about 4 or 5 hours last night editing an episode, and that's the magical thing. You know, we're on episode 4. Technically, and I just edited episode 1 last night, but no one will ever know.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm really gonna have to probably back up with all the fine-tuned, skillful editing because it's just exhausting, man. You know, we just have to improve our vocal performance. So, last time where we
Well.
left off, Cinna had been killed. He raised an army to set sail to Greece to confront Sulla. Preferably off of Italian soil. His troops mutinied and killed him. We have a lovely story about that in The Rising Sun Part 1. And Carbo says, well, you know, I think I'm just going to take my chances in Italy, starts raising a force. Allegedly, the 23-year-old Pompey tries to join his camp, but once allegations, maybe conspiracies against his life, you know, this guy's either really, really paranoid or everyone really hates him because we constantly have references to assassination attempts or conspiracies on Pompey's life. Or either way, we think that he tries to, or he actually does join Carbo's camp for a while, but eventually he's forced to flee to his homeland in Picenum, where his father and now he owns vast estates, has large amounts of clients, indebted soldiers, that sort of thing.
Right. And this is the year 83 BC, right? We're around 83 BC. Carbo is actually no longer the consul. He's taken up as a proconsul in Cisalpine Gaul. And to explain kind of the position of the consul and the proconsul, the consul was kind of the general of Rome. He was kind of the general slash president. And the proconsul, as Rome got bigger and bigger, proconsul stepped in as kind of the general's underling that could wage warfare in a larger area. So a proconsul might be assigned to a specific region, while the consul would have command over the proconsul. So it's kind of one step under the consul.
Yeah.
Often they would march together.
Yeah, and I think that in earlier times, I think I mentioned that in earlier times, you know, consuls would more likely control the armies, and we would see one or two, possibly four legions at a time. And by this point of in Roman history, especially with the permanent garrisons needed for provinces overseas, the number of legions that are required to remain in the field are increasingly larger and larger and larger, you know, 15, 12 legions. So the need for proconsular authority or for proconsuls to be taking command of these armies, even praetors, became a more and more common thing. And we'll see when Pompey triumphs later, and he becomes the first and last knight ever to triumph as a victorious general, when, you know, legally, triumphs were reserved exclusively for praetors and consuls. And the point I'm trying to make is, it probably wasn't very far-fetched or completely uncommon that praetors often led armies in the field when the need arose.
Right, so Carbo stepped down from the consul position into the proconsul position, and the consuls elected were pretty much his underlings, a consul named Scipio from the Scipionic family, and Norbanus, an individual named Norbanus. So these individuals, they started making a lot of preparations for war. I believe we talked in the last episode about Sulla sending his letter to the Senate and the Senate really starting to freak out. Carbo was in Cisalpine Gaul making his rapid preparations, trying to levy troops, and the consuls were in Campania attempting to levy troops there.
Oh, and they finally start getting it together. Apparently they send him overtures and ask him, hey, you know, if you come back, you know, we can help you out, you know, give you peace, help you relax. And Sulla's like, what are you kidding me? You are not the ones who are in the position to offer peace. You know, that's me. So Pompey does flee to Picenum, where Carbo's agents are already there, probably recruiting. Pompey, the 23-year-old Pompey, starts to immediately recruit from his father's estates. Pompey has money, not anything like the vast riches that he's eventually going to acquire, but he's probably pretty well off. His father would have been a wealthy man, and not to mention some of the money he would have gained via his conquest.
And I think it's also interesting to talk about Strabo in terms of the number of clientele he had. I think we talked about in the Social War, he actually extended rights to all the people south of the Po Valley, or into the Po Valley, all the way up to the River Po. So he really gained a lot of support, a lot of clients in the north of Italy, as well as serving as, I believe, governor in Sicily. So he had a lot of support in the south of Rome. And we have to remember, Sicily was one of the main grain-producing provinces for the Roman Republic of this time, as well as North Africa.
I like that. At the Capitol Museum, in the Capitoline Museum in Rome, there's a bronze tablet that is dated from 17 November 89 BC. And the records that are inscribed on it grant citizenship to a squadron of 30 Spanish cavalrymen by the consul Gnaeus Pompeius Strabo. There's bronze evidence. Yeah, I think that's brilliant too. Like you said, the giving the, what is it, Italians? Was it Italian rights or was it Roman citizenship to the Po Valley?
I believe it was just the Italian rights. I don't believe it was those Latin rights, but it was, I believe it was an Italian rights.
Well, either way.
But although I think during the Social War, this may have been Roman rights. Yeah, I believe it was Roman rights.
Well, either way, it really goes to illustrate the methodology that Pompey is going to embrace throughout his career. They both come from relatively obscure families. If you look at the Claudii or the Metelli, and even the Julii, which had largely fallen into obscurity during our period in the Republic, they still can boast of a very, very long blue-blooded lineage. But, you know, the Pompeys really couldn't. And we see in Pompey's father, and definitely in Pompey, his brilliant ability to get people to work for him and with him.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is often missed is, you know, when Strabo gathered all these clientelia in Sicily, perhaps in Sardinia, where he was I believe he had a praetorship in Sardinia. He also had, you know, all his estates in Picenum and into the Po Valley. You know, all these individuals were now, after the Social War, Roman citizens, and their champion was Strabo. And now we will see, you know, Pompey really utilize a lot of those clientelia. You know, and so it's really these clients of this new family, of really Strabo, who have a vested interest in seeing Pompey succeed, because his father was the one who was able to secure them rights.
It's a very interesting and powerful social institution, the patron and client relationship. And we'll see when Pompey eventually goes to Spain to fight more campaigns there, that towards the end of that expedition and conquest, he enfranchises some more Spanish tribes, I believe. We'll get to it. And it's not just, oh yeah, thanks, we're Romans, you know, I owe you one. We mentioned in previous episodes that to a Roman, if you weren't Roman, you didn't have the same rights to liberty, you know, life as a Roman did. And being a Roman citizen was more than just entitlement for voting, welfare, if it was available at the time. It was a jealously guarded position in life, and it was coveted by people who were not Romans. To not be a Roman could be a pretty miserable thing. I mean, ask the Greeks. Though the Romans loved them, they thought everyone should own one, and it just wasn't a good time unless you were part of the Enchanted Kingdom. Right,
specifically what the Allies during the Social War, and I believe we already went over this, but the Allies were angry, you know, on the one hand, because these new agricultural committees were basically ruling in the Romans' favor. So these lands that were originally the Italians before Roman conquest were now still being de facto occupied by a lot of the Italian citizens. However, these new latifundia were coming in, and also these agricultural reformists who were citing and trying to use the ager publicus as a political tool were now siding on the side of Romans. So that gave them a lot of hatred towards Rome. And on the other hand, they envied their citizenship and their ability to hold these forms and hold these laws. And I think we really see that, you know, dual, you know, love-hate relationship play out in the Social War. You know, we talked about Corfinium becoming Italia.
Yeah.
And the Italians erected a Senate. You know, they erected a lot of the same institutions that the Romans had because they did enjoy many aspects of the Roman system. However, there were also very oppressive overtones towards the Italians, making them second-class citizens.
There were some really unhappy provincials. And if you look at Mithridates' ability to constantly gather support against Rome, you know, Greece went over to Mithridates. He became sort of the poster child for fighting the oppression of the Roman Empire. So there was definitely a lot of oppression there. There were a lot of...
Especially in the East, if we're talking about the East, because what you had is you had a lot of these publicani, I believe we talked about in previous episodes, that were tax collectors. They formed these companies and they would literally bid on who could give the Roman people the most money. They would basically pay up front and then they would be allowed to go and collect taxes from these areas. And whatever excess they got from what they paid was their profit. So it was in their best interest to really extract as much from these territories as possible. And then the East, there was enough that they could extract a lot of the wealth, a lot of the cultural wealth. But in the West and Spain, you see a lot of strip mining, slavery, those type of things. Although there were quite a few people once the East was impoverished enough, you really see them come in and start making loans to these people so they could pay their debt to the Romans. And then, you know, and if you couldn't pay your loans, then you could sell your children into slavery. So, you really get this, really kind of nasty debt slavery institution that starts, rising. And, you know, I really think Mithridates is a really interesting character. He was a king of Pontus, and Pontus, if you know Italian or if you know Latin, Ponte means bridge, and Pontus is actually that part in modern-day Turkey that's really close to the Dardanelles, which is kind of the area that is the westernmost area in Turkey, and kind of contains the area right between kind of the Middle East and Europe. So he kind of straddles more of the Asian influence and sort of the Greek European influence. It's kind of this middle section, and he himself is a very interesting character because he rose to power. You know, he was actually his mother actually attempted to poison him, and he ended up escaping and living kind of a Tarzan-like existence out in the world. And yeah, he ended up coming back and imprisoning his mother and poisoning his brother.
Yeah, and then I'm actually reading this book right now on Mithridates, and I guess in his, it must have been his early 20s when he's roaming the Pontic countryside. And if you look at this region, Lesbos to, you know, the Euphrates, huge, huge, beautiful stretches of land. And, you know, in one of the kind of romantic stories is he becomes obsessed with, not an elixir of life, but like the ultimate antidote. he starts exploring. He was probably one of the most advanced botanists of the day, and he starts experimenting with and studying venomous creatures, poisonous, you know, I said poisonous plants, mushrooms. Mithridates spends a few years of his youth just wandering the countryside from Lesbos to the Euphrates, which is a huge bit of land, which is very diverse with life, animals, and he becomes one of the leading botanists of the time. Some of his work survives quite a bit after, and you know, none of this fun stuff is really mentioned by the Roman writers, but this was the man who was probably a bit too obsessed with, you know, discovering the perfect immunity to all the great poisons in the world. But yeah, he was very scientific with some of his findings. With
right, but you know, who can blame him for? I mean, obviously, in that era, in that time period, we're hearing a lot about different people being poisoned. You know, his own mother tried to poison him, apparently. And so I think in the myths surrounding Mithridates, there's probably a little bit of truth.
Well, you know, apparently when Pompey was in the East, and you know, I'm going to spoil this for you, he does conquer the East and Mithridates. But when Pompey is marching east, he has it in mind to reach the edge of the known world. Some sources say that he reached the Caspian and thought it was the edge of the known world, which I don't think is true. I think that's a little silly to think that anyone would think that. But that was definitely further than any Roman had marched with an army before, and so that was probably the significance of that. And I think that he did want to go further, probably to the edge of the known world, but according to Cassius Dio, Appian, I think we get it in Plutarch also, the scorpions on the ground, venomous snakes, reptiles, that sort of thing, were keeping his men from going any further. I mean, imagine insect and lizards keeping your army from marching to something like the edge of the known world, which would have been like landing in the moon and in the first century. When Julius Caesar invades Britain, the only context that I can really give you is the lunar landing with that one. But anyway, he turns back because of the poisonous indigenous life there. And that was something Mithridates would have been really interested in when he hears about a tribe or group of people who supposedly developed immunity to the venomous animals of the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, right. He is a fascinating character. You know, we see him come in and poison his brother. You know, we see him come in and imprison his mother and assume the throne. And then you talked a little bit about his interaction with the Greek world, because he is this Asian despot. But we see him get an appeal from help from a couple of Greek cities of the Bosporus and the Chersonesus, who were threatened by the Scythians and the Sarmatians who lived in the Crimea. And so he really latched onto this appeal from help, and he came in and he basically saved these Greek cities and established a capital of his Pontic Empire at Pentacapium. And then this is when he really started advancing east against Colchis and the Caucasus. So we're talking about the area around the Black Sea. So he basically goes and saves these Greeks that live in the Crimea area, which is north of the Black Sea. And then he starts wrapping around to, you know, modern day Georgia, Armenia, those areas. And this rapid expansion really provides him with an immense amount of corn, money, and men, which fuel really a Pontic war machine that's building. And at this point in time, you know, Rome is also rapidly expanding, and it's almost like two balloons that are expanding into each other, and, you know, one of them is going to have to give. Within a few short years, Mithridates becomes one of the most powerful forces in Asia, and perhaps the world at this point.
Yeah, I would, you know, I would agree, and I don't think that he's at all giving his due justice by the Roman writers, naturally.
And, you know, at this point, once he captures all these eastern kingdoms of Colchis and the Caucasus, he ends up starting to expand into Greece. He kind of turns his eye towards Greece, and he's kind of looking at the Aetolian Empire. And if you know anything about, I know we didn't really get into it, the Macedonian Wars, the Aetolians were the Greek tribe that really allied with Rome against the heir to Antigonus Doson, who was Philip V. So they basically made a common alliance of these Greek states and the Aetolians and the Lacedaemonians, who are the Spartans, allied together. And Rome, as it started expanding into that area, really started allying themselves with the Aetolians. So Mithridates is really kind of eyeballing this new Aetolian empire that was set up, you know, during set up by the Romans, to kind of de facto rule the area of Greece. So he's really wanting to come in and challenge this Aetolian power structure in Greece. And so, you know, this was kind of happening at the same time, that the Jugurthine Wars that we talked about were happening, and the Teutons and the Cimbri were occupying Rome, or were attempting to march on Rome. So that kind of gives you an approximate date of when these things were occurring. So at the same time that Rome was really cementing their newfound territories, Mithridates was rapidly expanding, and he was eyeballing Greece. So basically, this brings us to Nicomedes II of Bithynia. And Nicomedes II of Bithynia was kind of a tragic character. He was a friend and ally of Rome. However, he was really bitter against Rome because all of the publicani, these tax collectors, were exploiting Bithynia to a point where they no longer even had slaves to give, because Rome had already taken them all. 104, he basically switches sides, and he joins up with Mithridates against this whole, you know, Roman occupation, this Roman de facto nation building or city-state building in Greece, or empire building. Nicomedes switches sides, and Nicomedes and Mithridates both decide to seize Galatia and Paphlagonia in 104. At this point, Saturninus is kind of on the scene in Rome. He's protesting, but his protests are quickly stifled in a torrent of money and bribes. And then the two kings decide to turn against Cappadocia. So basically, Marius, at this point, we're now fast forwarding to 98. Marius is, during his kind of de facto self-imposed retirement, he's kind of over in...
A little backup to give you some background on the war in Asia. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. So basically, Marius, he went, did this during his retirement after the Saturninus affair. He goes to the east to conduct some business, and he ends up running into Mithridates, and he warns him, you know, I forget what he exactly said, but he basically warns Mithridates to stay out of Rome's way, don't interfere with Rome, and do what you're told and shut up. So that's kind of whether he actually did that or not, who knows, but it sounds good. And about 1 to 2 years after that,
you know, I like to believe a lot of the kind of the fun stories about Mithridates. Here was a guy who, like you said, he had that Greek influence in him. He, you know, he was a Hellenized monarch, and he would have been very familiar with the classics, the stories of Alexander the Great, the Iliad, Greek literature. So he probably had some really fun romantic notions of kingship, something that he did do as part of his rule was to be surprisingly generous, and then at other times steadfastly cruel, which was kind of an endearing attribute of a ruler, to be able to be stern and also be very forgiving. And by all accounts, he really tried to kind of emulate his hero, Alexander the Great, in his dress and styles and statuary. So I think that he deliberately did a lot of this stuff because he was emulating his hero, but he was also just a master propagandist. I mean,
yeah, he really was. He, you know, I don't think I've ever read anything, even in modern day history, military history, of a coordinated assassination of 80,000 people all occurring in one day across multiple cities. I mean, that is a feat of logistics and military engineering that is unfathomable, and we'll get into that. But
yeah, I mean, you know, basically, maybe it was a terrorist attack. I mean, however you want to label it, I'm sure in the Asiatic mind, and probably to his subjects, he was the liberator of the oppressive Roman government, being able to coordinate a massacre without a peep being made of 80,000 people is, at the very least, a testament of absolute brilliant administration. Probably the greatest co-op of conspiracy the world's ever fabricated. So
he almost becomes like a Osama bin Laden figure, you know? He's kind of like the terrorist, you know, kingpin, at least in my, you know, modern American mind. You know, he kind of becomes this figure. You know, he practices a weird Asiatic religion. You know, he almost has a sort of a cult around him, this cult of Mithras, you know, as we learn later. But it's he's almost like a weird throwback to like an ancient sort of terrorist, you know, leader or something.
Maybe like the Asian Hannibal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that. Although I think
probably in his mind, he's the Pontic Alexander, and I like to imagine that the matrons in Rome were probably telling their children that were unruly or wouldn't go to bed on time that the boogeyman Mithridates is going to get them if they don't.
Yeah. They don't simmer down. Yeah, exactly. And so basically, sorry to get we got ahead of ourselves, but so basically, Mithridates and Nicomedes start taking over Cappadocia. And so what happens when they start taking over Cappadocia is the Roman Senate reacts and they come in and they support this guy named Ariobarzanes, who claimed to be the proper king of Cappadocia. Probably just a Roman puppet, but there you have it. So basically, that happens in 96, and the Senate nominates Sulla to go and install this new king, Ariobarzanes. Sulla was appointed the proconsul of Cilicia, which is kind of an area in northern Syria, southern Turkey, where a lot of the conflicts are going on right now. And so Sulla is there, and he ends up clashing with troops of a king named Tigranes of Armenia, and then he goes on to the Euphrates, which is kind of in modern-day Iraq, and he accepts an offer of the Parthian Empire, which we are really going to talk about the Parthian Empire in the future. They are really an interesting empire that's kind of on the very outskirts of Roman influence, and they really lay some devastating blows to the Roman Empire later, and then they are subsequently conquered by the Romans. So basically, Mithridates was checked, but basically he secures Tigranes as a son-in-law, and Tigranes would become Mithridates' right-hand man through the rest of these Mithridatic wars. So basically, at this point, Rome was really busy with the social wars, and Mithridates ends up securing Bithynia and Cappadocia in 90, with the help of Tigranes, and the Romans will not stand for this. So they send out Manius Aquilius. Manius Aquilius was an agent of Marius, and it's kind of my thought that perhaps Manius Aquilius was going out. You know, he was set up with a commission to restore Nicomedes to the throne of Bithynia. However, I really think that he was perhaps agitating to stir up trouble, so that Marius could later claim this Mithridatic war. You know, I really think they were angling for this this position. We see it a lot with, you know, a lot of Sulla's plotting after the war with the Teutons and the Kimbri's. They really start laying it on with the legislation, providing full military, kind of extraordinary military powers to be allotted to deal with this rise in pirates that is going on in the Mediterranean. And this kind of this rise in pirates becomes something of a stepping stone to the Mithridatic campaign. But you have, you know, I believe it was Saturninus that was actually brought to trial for insulting a emissary of Mithridates in Rome. And then you have, you know, now Manius Aquilius, which is an agent of Marius, officially going to restore Nicomedes to the throne of Bithynia, which he was deprived of by, you know, his old ally, Mithridates. But now you have Manius Aquilius out there covertly, I believe, stirring up trouble against Mithridates in the area on behalf of Rome. So he basically makes even more drastic demands than Sulla made. When he was out there, he basically orders Mithridates out of both of the kingdoms of Bithynia and Cappadocia. And then he also demands that he supply Roman troops, which is kind of par for the course. It's kind of part of the Roman agreement. You can be on Rome's good side if you give them men so they can go out and conquer more. And it just kind of fuels that Roman war machine. But basically, Mithridates ends up reinvading Cappadocia in 88. And then the Romans taking part in the social war. They only have one legion in Asia. And they end up, you know, so they only have one legion in Asia. And they persuade Nicomedes to just attack Pontus directly. And Nicomedes, not having really any men, was swiftly defeated. And that's why he's such a tragic character. And then the Romans divide their forces into three. They're as well defeated under Manius Aquilius, and Manius Aquilius is captured and killed. So you have Mithridates sweeping through Asia now, promising freedom to all the Greek cities, canceling all the taxes.
And this is really, sorry, I wanted to back up a little bit. We do have some accounts that it was advantageous to be under Roman rule. Like you said, these Italians, when they revolted, they didn't rip off their clothes and say down with Rome. You know, they formed Rome 2.0 right over here at Corfinium. But at the same time, you know, what, 100, 150 years ago, you know, Rome was thought to be the patrons of free Greece. And here we have cities like Athens in an open revolt against Rome.
Right, because it was so...
I thought that'd be a little more poignant than that, but
These tax collectors, you know, are oppressing the Greeks so bad that they are willing to reach out to anyone to throw off the yoke of these oppressive tax collectors, moneylenders, and the Roman military, which is ultimately the force of violence that supports these institutions.
And with the equites having control of the courts, which, and I hate giving stuff away, but which Sulla's going to do something about when he comes back on Rome, but with the equites controlling the courts, it's not a good situation. It's not a good situation for a provincial. I mean, imagine being, you're the one sitting on the jury for your own friends. You're the judge of your buddy's extortion crimes. You know, you get to judge if your best friend is being corrupt or not. And it's just bad business for the provincials, but it's good business if you're a businessman.
Yeah. And so basically Mithridates ends up sailing into the Aegean, which is the sea that is on the eastern side of Greece. He sails into the Aegean. Rhodes puts up a resistance to the siege. We'll see Rhodes be one of the Roman allies that kind of maintains their ground, holds their ground. So
during the Macedonian War, didn't Rome take Rhodes' side against Corinth? Rhodes was steadfast. And as a consequence, Corinth was burned to the ground. If I can't back that up, I'll delete it from the episode. But you know, Corinth is a pretty big popular city, and you know, Roman has this thing about supremacy, and you know, they burned Corinth to the ground for their defection.
Exactly. If it's kind of one of those, if you oppose Rome, they will make sure that you feel it, and your grandchildren will feel their wrath.
Well, there's this old saying, you know, the ram has touched the wall. And I think that a lot of Romans thought it was just, but, you know, when you're invading an enemy, basically you're giving every opportunity to surrender where you can enjoy maybe your life, or maybe you can become integrated into the Roman system. And, you know, in a Roman mind, it's all like, hey, you know, we have clothes and running water, but to other people, it's a pretty unbearable thing. But they kind of had this mentality that, you know, once the ram touches the wall, and you refuse every opportunity to surrender, well, once the onslaught begins, you know, there's really no turning back. And we see this again and again.
And this is kind of why the Greek world viewed Rome as a barbaric force. You know, they were actually viewed as kind of an ancient force because Alexander the Great did probably equally as horrible things that the Romans did. But the Greek world had not experienced that intense of a sacking of a city in hundreds of years. You know, at this point, for the Macedonian Wars, they were not, you know, prepared for that. And one of the things that agitated the Romans too was, you know, how the Greeks would do a lot of their alliances and treaties. You know, they allied with the Aetolians, but the Aetolians also allied with, you know, Philip V. So there's, you know, and that kind of agitated the Romans because they felt like they were being dealt with underhandedly. Because their allies were also allying with the enemies, but the Greeks thought this was an expedient move and politically wise move for themselves. And they had no problems making treaties like that as far as they serve the expediency of the problems of the current moment.
And it wasn't a bad...
I'm sorry.
It wasn't a bad gamble. Greece had, if you're even slightly familiar with history, Greece had, as far as being a world power goes, of course there were lots of city-states, but Greece has long fallen into obscurity, partially with the rise of Rome, but Athens still had a considerable navy at this time, and backing Mithridates ended up being a pretty horrible gamble, but, you know, for the perspective of these Asiatic kingdoms, Mithridates was a good investment to throw your lot in with.
And I think at this point you have, you know, he's starting to go through Asia to all these Greek cities, canceling the taxes. And what he does is really interesting. He ends up, we've already talked about it, he ends up organizing the murder of these Roman and Italian businessmen that were kind of the main oppressors of the Greek cities.
In the meantime, he's taxing his subjects fairly. On top of that, he's vastly rich, and in his whole career, he never runs out of rooms full of money. He's taxing people fairly. Justly,
which we actually see Romans start to do after, you know, after this period, they you know, which kind of agitates the Romans at home, you know, because they're so lenient. It actually starts to agitate the Roman military under Lucullus later on. What he does on a fixed day. He has all the men, women, and children that are Roman and Italian murdered. It's 8,000 people that are massacred all throughout Asia and Greece. And this really binds these cities against Rome. You know, once you've done this to Rome, there will be no forgiveness from Rome. What happens kind of at the same time, you have Ariston of Athens. He's an ambassador with the Democratic Party. You know, as opposed to their aristocratic party, you know, he basically goes and sends an invitation to Mithridates to come and liberate Greece. And on Ariston's return to Athens, he basically becomes a tyrant of Athens and murders the members of the aristocratic party. And this basically starts Mithridates' entrance into Greece, which is firmly in the sphere of influence of Rome. I mean, this is basically Rome's backyard.
And, you know, so thus, Mithridates has to be dealt with by Roman force. And, you know, Sulla is, like you've mentioned, is sent there to deal with the Mithric forces in Asia. And we talked about in the last podcast that, you know, we have already done our bit on poor Marius, but the glory, the money, the prestige, combined with his own dipping popularity, you know, Marius just gets this horrendous jealousy towards Sulla, has his command taken away and given to him illegally, you know, which is where the civil war starts. And I think that Sulla is a genuine organizer, and on paper his reforms are actually pretty brilliant. But, you know, he does leave Rome in a pretty bad state. He tries to put a band-aid on a couple of the fixes, but as soon as his back's turned in Asia, obviously, the civil war continues in Rome. His friends are killed. The Marians take control of the city. He's in Asia dealing with Mithridates, which is a pretty serious force. But he's in a pretty... We see in the histories that he's in a pretty big rush to get back. And despite Mithridates' horrendous crimes, he strikes a deal with Sulla, where he gets to keep most of his ancestral kingdom. Mithridates has to pay an indemnity to Rome And he's basically off the hook. And I think that's mostly because Solo really had to get back to Rome and deal with the Marian situation.
Right, but isn't it interesting, too, how quickly he left? You know, because he kind of promised these, Octavius and Cinna, you know, he kind of forced them to promise him that he would impose, they would not change the changes that he made while he was out fighting this Mithridatic conquest. He orders Sulla to return, or he orders Strabo to return his troops to Rome. Strabo doesn't. Then he sends Strabo's cousin, Pompeius Rufus, to assume command of his troops, and the troops murder him, Pompeius Rufus, and then Sulla quickly leaves.
And then he does some patchwork in Asia to get back to Italy, and Mithridates was definitely let off the hook, you know, especially for killing all, 80,000 Romans. He got off easily, and that ends up really coming back on Rome. That's not the end of Mithridates, but for the time being, he stays in Asia, and Sulla comes back to Rome. In 83 BC, news of Sulla reaches Rome, news that Sulla lands in Brundisium reaches Pompey, who's in Picenum. While in Picenum, Pompey recruits 6,000 men. Though Plutarch says he raised 3 legions, but this number is probably pretty careless, and most people think that he probably raised this army over time, and with his first battle, some of these men probably defect to Pompey's side. Did I jump ahead too far here?
No, I think we're good. Sulla lands in Brundisium in 83.
In raising these armies, which must have represented spectacular wealth, to be able to equip an army of just your pals, was right, extremely illegal. it's absolutely no different than if Jeb Bush says, you know what, I want that, and he equips an army and marches on DC. It's really no different. At this time, I just want to add, because I'm sure you've got something, around this time, Marcus Licinius Crassus and Metellus Pius, they also equip armies.
I think, that's really where, we really got to focus in, because I think it's really important that we explain Metellus Pius's position. The Metelli, Metellus had the victory stolen from him in the Jugurthine War. And then later, when Marius was trying to make all the Senate take that oath, Metellus was the only one that didn't take the oath. So his family was.
Well, I think that Marius. Obviously, I think Marius took it, and then he backed out of the oath.
Metellus Numidicus chose exile over taking the oath. He said absolutely not. To Marius's, kind of trick at this point.
Which is commendable, because at one point Caesar tries to pull the same tactic. Along with this little bit of law, we're also going to pass another law that says if any senator at any time tries to repeal or oppose this legislation, he's committing a crime, which is ridiculous.
And it's even that tacking that the Lex Calicia Didia kind of opposed later on. But basically, Metellus Pius is the son of Metellus Numidicus, the one that was waging the war against Jugurtha and went into exile. So basically, Metellus Pius meets with Sulla on the Via Appia, and he still has his troops, and he still is a proconsul, because we still have some of the social war going on in the south. The Samnites never really officially surrendered, and they were never really included in the terms of the Lex Julia, or any of those, or any of the laws that get enfranchised the Italians. So, basically he can't go back to Rome. Metellus Pius can't go back to Rome because he's an enemy of the Marians, and so he's kind of stranded with this army. And the one thing Sulla needs is legitimacy. So at this point, when Metellus joins Sulla against their common enemy of the Marians, it's giving Sulla a lot of the legitimacy that he's lacking. Mm. Yeah, at this point.
And according to Appian, whose numbers aren't always the most accurate, but they're always the most fun. Well, except for Caesar's, which is usually, hey, you know, we slaughtered 70,000 enemies, and I lost 4 centurions. No, I'm kidding. Sulla lands in Brundisium with 40,000 men. At this point, the Marians, Carbo had been up pretty good work, and this includes Centorius. The Marians had 250 cohorts, and cohorts 500 men. So Sulla lands with 40,000 men, and he's facing about 250,000 potential hostiles against him. Pompey's intelligence was already at work, and we'll see Pompey's brilliant ability to maneuver and organize. And his intelligence is already working, and he gets reports that there are 3 armies in a position to attack him from 3 different positions. So,
right. And so I think it's interesting because at first, you know, Carbo really didn't take Pompey seriously, but we're told that there's a local meeting, where a person kind of makes a remark that, you know, evidently Pompey left his pedagogues to become a demagogue amongst the Picenums. And, you know, this is really making a jab at his youth, because we have to remember how young he was at this point.
At 23.
Basically, this person was taken when he made that statement, and he was lynched.
The same. We have the same story with his father.
It really should, and this really illustrates, you know, Pompey's influence and the loyalty he commands in that area and his prestige in the area, you know, and Carbo's agents that are kind of spying on Pompey at that time start to raise their eyebrow, and especially right afterwards, because Pompey ends up setting up a tribunal at Axium in the marketplace, and he starts trying to enlist troops. Pompey ends up supplying and arming these men, you know, really with his own wealth, and he ends up organizing him with his own military experience that he got from, you know, serving with his father, Strabo, you know, during the social wars. So he basically starts organizing them into a proper army, and the centuries, cohorts. He starts appointing centurions and officers. You know, he really is making an effective fighting force, which I don't think Carbo was anticipating.
And on the subject on the subject of recruitment, this is where Pompey probably met or enlisted some of the characters that are going to come into our story later. Some people who support Pompey throughout his life, and since a lot of his supporters are beneath him in rank, you know, he doesn't really deal with a great deal of jealousy amongst his friends. So again, Pompey has a skill of who he utilizes and who he trusts. During this equipment in Picenum, this is probably where he enlists Titus Labienus Gabinius, who we'll hear from, and someone who will play a role throughout Pompey's life, will become consul, and will play a role in the civil war between Julius Caesar and Pompey, Lucius Afranius. So anyway, yes, Carbo does take Pompey seriously, and 3 armies are sent against him, as I said, apparently in 3 different directions. So
yeah, and Afranius actually becomes one of the consuls in the first year of the first triumphant. He becomes one of the consuls along with one of the Metelli. So I mean, these are really essential people that he's really starting to throw in with, you know.
Yeah.
And support, and you know, so basically Carbo has these agents he's trying to recruit. Carbo and the consuls Scipio and Norbanus are trying to recruit from everywhere, using every resource they have to raise an army. And Pompey is also raising an army in Axium. And once he's strong enough, he actually orders Carbo's recruiting agents out of the city.
Oh yeah.
And then he ends up marching around to all the neighboring towns and cities and begins recruiting there. And we're told, I believe it was by Appian, maybe in Plutarch, that he had at least 6,000 men by the time Sulla landed in Brundisium. So
it's at about this 3 legions.
Yeah, at this time, Carbo is looking at Pompey as a force to be reckoned with, because he's not just organizing, you know, angry men with pitchforks. He's organizing and training professional Roman legions, Roman cohorts.
It goes without saying that a lot of these recruited men were probably former clients or even soldiers of his father's. Now, Pompey's career almost ends before it began. He was popular with the troops, but he had a little experience. When he was faced with these three armies in apparently three different directions, he was not able to join Sulla straight away, but he did move fast. He decided to strike first, and he attacked the closest army, and apparently he led the cavalry in person. He charged straight for the commander of the enemy cavalry and ran him through. The confused remaining cavalry smashed into the troops' line, and apparently the two other commanders were unable to agree on action, and...
So, you know, we see Pompey not only commanding and organizing these armies, but he's actually engaging in some of the fiercest combat at the very beginning of this war. You know, I believe this was the first engagement of the Civil War.
Yeah,
that I know about.
And yeah, absolutely. And after it's pretty obvious, but after his father dies, that is the last time in Pompey's life that he is a subordinate to another commander. Next, Pompey faces Scipio, who's the consul. And I don't know how, if this story gets mixed up when with Scipio, the consul confronts Sulla. But next, Pompey is faced by Scipio, the consul. And before they were in range of each other, before the first javelins were even thrown, Pompey's men started shouting greetings. The enemy forces came over to Pompey, and Scipio fled. And that's all the time we have for today, folks. But tune in next time, and we will see what happens in Pompey's second engagement and the aftermath of the Civil War. And don't forget, you can check us out at lifeofpompey.wordpress.com, and you can subscribe to us via Feedburner. I just love that. You could subscribe to us, and our podcast can be automatically downloaded anywhere you like. And please don't hesitate to like or share or comment, because that's really where we get our feedback from, is the comments, especially on iTunes. So don't forget to check us out there. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always email us at lifeofpompey.gmail.com. Thank you again for listening to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast. I'm Alan Keith, and you've been listening to Luke Murphy.